Oh, but it is. His voice, with a musical lilt, was kind. My name is Crayon. You are indeed in the time epoch known as Pliocene and on the planet Earth, which some call exile, and others, the many-colored land. You've been disoriented by your passage through the time portal, perhaps more seriously than the rest of your companions, but that's understandable. I've given you a mild, strengthening draft that will restore you. In a few minutes, if you please, we'll talk. Your friends are being interviewed now by people of our staff who welcome all new arrivals. They're resting in rooms like this one, having a bit of food and drink and asking questions that we're doing our best to answer. The guardians of the gate alerted me to your distress. They were also able to perceive that you are a most unusual traveler, which is why I am interviewing you myself. Elizabeth had closed her eyes again as the man droned easily on. Peace and relief permeated her mind. So there really is a land of exile, and I've really managed to come into it safely. Now I can forget what I've lost. I can build a new life. She opened her eyes wide. The tall man's smile had become ironic. Your life will certainly be new, he agreed. But what is lost?
You can hear me?
Yes.
She leaped to her feet, drew breath, cried out in a shattering scream, vocalization of ecstasy, life found restored, renewed, gratitude. Softly, she told herself, draw back from the pinnacle. Gently. After that first mad interior leap, go cautiously. Reach out at the simplest possible mode, at wide, wide focus, for you are weak with rebirth.
We rejoice with you, Elizabeth.
Crayon, you permit shallow question?
Shrug. Elizabeth slipped clumsily beneath the surface of his smile, where a neat reticulation of data waited passively for her study. But the deeper layers were shielded by warning hardness. She snatched up the proffered information and got out quickly. Her throat had gone dry, and her heart pounded with the shock of the assimilation. Gently, gently. Two mental blows within a few minutes on her raw tenderness. Suspend, heal, allow, self-redaction. He cannot read deeply or far, but coerce, yes. Redact, yes, most strongly. Other abilities? No data. She spoke out loud at last in a calm voice. Crayon, you are not a human being and you are not a true operant metapsychic. These two things contradict my experience so that I am confused. In the world I come from, only persons with operant metapsychic powers are able to communicate in purely mental speech, and only 6 races in all our galaxy possess the genes for metability. You belong to none of them. May I probe deeper to learn more about you?
I regret that I cannot permit it at this time. Later there will be suitable opportunities for us to get to know one another.
Are there many of your people here?
A sufficient number.
In the split second that he replied, she hurled a redactive deep probe with all her strength right between his pale blue eyes. It bounced and shattered. She had to cry out with the violence of the rebound, and the man named Crayon laughed.
Elizabeth. That was most impolite. And it won't work.
Shame. It was an impulse, a social error I apologize for. In our world, no metapsychic would dream of probing without invitation unless placed in a threat situation. I don't know what came over me.
You've been discomposed by the portal.
Wonderful, dreadful, pitiless one-way portal. It's more than that, she said, sinking back into the chair. She did a swift tour of her mental defenses, up and fairly secure, rawness crusting over, familiar patterns reasserting. Back on the other side, she said, I suffered a serious brain injury. My metafunctions were obliterated in the regeneration process. It was thought that the loss was permanent. Otherwise, she gave it mental underlining, I never would have been allowed to cross into exile, nor would I have wanted to come.
We are most fortunate. Welcome from all Tanu.
You've had no other operant metas come through?
A group of nearly 100 arrived abruptly some 27 years ago. I'm sorry to say they were unable to adapt to our local conditions.
Caution, caution, wallop. Elizabeth nodded. They would have been fugitive rebels. It was a sad time for our galactic milieu. Are all of them dead then? Am I the only operant in exile?
Perhaps not for long.
She braced herself on the table, rose, and walked closer to him. His amiable expression changed.
It is not our custom to enter lightly into another's private space. I request you, in courtesy, to withdraw.
Polite regret. I simply wanted to look at your golden collar. Would you take it off so that I can examine it? It seems to be a remarkable piece of craftsmanship.
Horrors. I'm sorry, Elizabeth. The golden torque bears a weight of religious symbolism among us. We wear it as long as we live.
I think I understand. She began to smile. Probe.
Elizabeth laughed aloud. Now you must apologize, Crayon.
Chagrin, unease, regrets, Elizabeth.
You will take some getting used to. She turned away.
What will become of me?
You'll go to our capital city, Rich Moriah, on the White Silver Plain. It lies in the south of this many-colored land. We'll have a wonderful welcome for you there among the Tanu, Elizabeth.
She spun around and met his eyes. Those that you rule, will they welcome me too?
Caution. They will love you as they love us. Try to suspend judgment on us until you have all of the data. I know that there are aspects of your situation that trouble you now, but have patience. You are in no danger.
What happens to my friends, the people who came through the time portal with me?
Some of them will be coming to the capital. Others have already indicated that they prefer to go elsewhere. We'll find good places for all of them. They'll be happy.
Happy ruled? Unfree?
We do rule, Elizabeth, but kindly. You'll see. Don't judge until you see what we've done with this world. It was nothing, and we've transformed it, just this little corner, into something marvelous.
It was too much. Her head began to throb again, and vertigo came. She dropped back into the soft cushions of the bench. Where did you come from? I know every sentient race in our milieu 6 million years into the future, coaginate and non. There is no people resembling you, except for humans. And I'm certain you're not of our genus. Your mental pattern is different.
Differences, similarities, parallels. Star whirlpools in countless numbers to the uttermost limit. I see. No one in my future time has managed intergalactic travel. We have not yet been able to supersede the pain barrier of the necessary translation. It rises geometrically with the increase in distance.
Mitigant. How interesting. If it were only possible to transmit information about that back through the portal.
We can discuss this later, Elizabeth, in the capital. There are other possibilities, even more intriguing, that will be made clearer to you in Moriah.
Distraction. He fingered his gold necklet, and at once there was a tapping on the door. A nervous little man in blue stepped into the room and saluted Crayon, by placing his fingers to his forehead.
The Tanu gave a regal gesture of acknowledgement. Elizabeth, this is Tully, one of our trusted interviewers. He's been talking to your companions, discussing their plans for the future, and answering their questions.
Have all of them recovered from the passage? She asked. I'd like to see them, talk to them.
In good time, lady, said Tully. All of your friends are safe and in good hands, you mustn't worry. Some of them will be going south with you, while others have chosen to travel to another city in the north. They feel their talents will be appreciated more up there. You'll be interested to know that caravans will be leaving here this very evening, going in both directions.
I see. But did she? Her thoughts were muddled again. She threw a tentative query at Crayon, which he parried neatly. Trust in me, Elizabeth. All will be well.
She turned back to the little interviewer.
I want to be sure of saying goodbye to those of my friends who are going north.
Certainly, lady, it will be arranged. The little man put a hand to his necklet, and Elizabeth looked at it closely. It seemed identical to the one worn by Crayon, except for the dark color of the metal.
Crayon, I want to put this one to the question. Disdain. He is under our protection. Would you distress him in premature attempts to satisfy curiosity? Questioning would distress him very much. Perhaps permanent harm. He has little data. But do as you wish with him.
Thank you for telling me about my friends, Tully, she said in a gentle tone. The man in blue looked relieved. Then I'll just run along to the next interview, shall I? I imagine Lord Crayon has already answered all of your questions about, general matters.
Not quite all.
She reached for pitcher and glass and poured some of the cold drink. But I expect he will, in time. 4. No sooner had the blue-clad interrogator left the room than Aiken Drum was testing the wooden door, discovering that it was locked and doing something about it. He used the tough glassy needle of a leather-working fid to probe the slot where the brass latch bar came through until he was able to lift a concealed pawl that was preventing the notched bar from moving. Opening the door carefully, he saw the device on the other side that activated the locking mechanism. A tiny stone from the door served to jam it. He pulled the door shut and went creeping down the hallway, passing other closed rooms where he assumed his comrades from Group Green were incarcerated. He wouldn't let them out yet. Not until he looked things over to see how he might take advantage of this strange situation. There was something powerful, as well as peculiar, at work here in the Pliocene, and it was obvious that it would take more than the simple-minded schemes of Stein and Richard to con the local yokels. Look out! He darted into one of the deep window bays that overlooked the castle's inner courtyard. Whipping out his chameleon poncho, he hunkered down in the shadows and tried to blend inconspicuously into the stone floor. 4 sturdy guardians, led by a man in blue, went dashing down the corridor in the direction from which Aiken had come. They never looked in his direction, and in a moment the reason became apparent. There was a roar of rage in the distance and a muffled crash. Heavy blows began to ring against the inner side of one of the reception room doors. Aiken peered from his alcove in time to see the group of castle lackeys cringe away from the first door at the head of the stairway. Even from his viewpoint more than 10 meters away, Aiken could see the slabs of thick oak tremble from the force of rhythmic smashes. The guardian in blue paused outside the door and fingered his torque in an agony of apprehension. The 4 other men gaped as their leader screeched, "You let him keep the iron axe? You stupid turds!" "But Master Sully, we put enough soporific in his beer to stun a mastodon." "But not enough to even slow down this Viking maniac, that's obvious," Tully hissed. The door vibrated with a particularly mighty blow, and the point of Stein's axe blade showed momentarily through broken wood before it was pulled back. "He'll be out of there in minutes.
Selene, run for Lord Crayon. We'll need a very large gray torque. Alert Castellan Pitkin and the security squad, too. Kilolo, bring more guardians with a net, and tell Fritz to close the portcullis in case he gets away down the stairway. Hurry! If we can net this bastard as he breaks through, we might just salvage this crock of shit.
The two guardians raced off in opposite directions. Aiken shrank back into the shadows.
Good old Steiny. Somehow he'd seen through the facade of phony goodwill and decided to take direct action. Drugged beer. Good God. Suppose the coffee had been doped, too. He hadn't taken more than half a cup, though. And he'd tried to play the game their way when Tully interviewed him. He felt certain he'd put himself over as a potentially useful but harmless little clown handyman. Maybe they only drugged the big, dangerous-looking types.
"Hurry, hurry, hurry up, you fools!" Tully wailed. "He's breaking out!"
This time Aiken didn't dare look back, but he heard a triumphant bellow and a squawk of splintering wood.
"I'll teach you to lock me in," Stein's voice called out. "Wait till I get my hands on that little white-bellied prick who juiced my beer. Yah, yah, yah!"
A very tall figure dressed in scarlet and white went striding past Aiken's refuge, trailed by a jangling squad of warriors, all human, wearing domed kettle helmets and heavy coats of yellowish scale armor.
"Lord Crayon," came Tully's voice. "I've sent for the net and more men. Oh, thank Tana, they're here."
Lying flat on the floor under the poncho, Aiken wormed over the stones until he had a good view down the corridor. Stein, yelling with each blow of the axe, had enlarged the hole in the door until it was nearly large enough to permit his escape. The people from the castle had regained their discipline with the coming of Crayon and stood waiting. Six armored men had a strong net deployed on the floor. Two more soldiers poised on either side of the disintegrating door with clubs as thick as a man's arm and studded with rounded metal knobs. The unarmed guardians fell back in a protective line before the towering form of Crayon.
"Yeah!"
cried Stein, kicking the last obstructing pieces of oak from the opening. His horned Viking helmet popped out for an eye blink and then withdrew for the charge. He emerged with a leap that carried him nearly to the opposite side of the broad corridor, beyond reach of the net, and into the midst of the guardians gathered about their awesome master. Men in white flung themselves at the berserker with despairing screams. Stein hewed at them, both hands swinging the battle axe in short, vicious arcs that sheared through flesh and bone and sent pathetic, severed things bouncing from walls and along the floor, fountaining crimson as they rolled. The armored soldiers clubbed at him without effect and tried to seize his arms, while he kept chopping at the barrier of living and dead men separating him from Crayon. In some way, Stein knew very well who his principal enemy was.
"I'll get you!" the Viking roared.
Crayon's robes showed scarcely any white now. He stood impassively against the wall, fingering the golden ring about his throat. One soldier finally snatched the horned helmet from Stein's head, while another swung a club, catching the giant at the back of the neck with a force that would have crushed the bones of a less heroic vertebral column. For 3 long seconds the Viking stood like a grotesque statue, his axe raised within easy striking distance of Crayon's head. Then Stein's fingers loosened. The weapon went tumbling down behind his back. His knees bent slowly and his head fell onto his breast as the net was belatedly flung over him. One of the warriors drew a short bronze sword and rushed forward, eyes glittering. Before he could strike, he halted, as though paralyzed. Another soldier pried the blade from his hand.
"No one is to harm this one," the Tanu overlord said. He moved through the shambles until he could look down upon Stein's unconscious body. Kneeling on the gory flags, Crayon held out his hand for the short sword and used it to cut the meshes covering Stein's head. Then he took a gray metal torque from a large pouch at his belt and fitted it about the fallen rock driller's neck.
"He is harmless now. You may remove the net."
Take him to a fresh reception room, and clean him up so that I may treat his wounds. He'll be most welcome in the capital. Rising, Crayon beckoned for a pair of soldiers to accompany him. All three of them made bloody footprints as they walked toward Aiken's hiding place, slowed, and stopped. Come out, Crayon said.
Ah, well.
Aiken gave him a grin as he scrambled to his feet. He flourished his hat in a mock salute and bowed from the waist. Before he realized what was happening, Crayon bent down and snapped something around his neck.
Oh, Christ, Aiken thought. Not me, too.
You are a completely different breed of cat, Aiken Drum, and bound for more sophisticated amusements than your muscular friend. Aiken craned his head to look into the wintry eyes far above him. The Tanu's hair, that had been so sleek and shining, was clotted now with the blood of men who had died defending him. Died unwillingly, from the sound of their hopeless screams. Freed from the symbol and source of their bondage, only at the moment that Stein's blade severed their heads from their bodies.
I suppose you can do what you like with us, once you've put on these fucking dog collars,
Aiken said bitterly, touching the thing about his own throat. It was warm. For one fraction of a second, he felt a flash of pleasure born in his loins go racing along his nerves like lightning through wires, before it exited his body through tingling fingers and toes.
What the hell?
Did you like that? It's only a sample of what we can give you. But our greatest gift will be the fulfillment of your own potential, freeing you even as you serve us.
The way these poor sods served, headless trunks, piled limbs awash in blood?
Amusement. Your own torque is silver and not gray, as befits a latent metapsychic made operant. You're going to enjoy the Pliocene very much, my lad.
Well, I'll be damned, Aiken exclaimed aloud.
Delight, delight, delight!
How many of the functions am I strong in?
Find out for yourself.
A built-in master control mechanism in the collar for you guys, I presume.
What do you think? Aiken gave a crooked grin.
Better than gray? Less than gold. Tell you what, I'll take it.
He folded his poncho carefully and stowed it back into his lumbar pouch.
What next, Chief?
We'll let you wait in a fresh reception room for now. One with a more effective lock. In a few hours you'll be leaving for our capital city, Moriah. Don't be apprehensive. Life here in exile can be very pleasant.
As long as I know who's boss?
Affirm. The guards hustled Aiken Drum through a door. He called over his shoulder,
Have one of your flunkies bring me a good stiff drink, will you, Chief? All this fightin' raises a terrible thirst in a man.
Crayon had to laugh.
It will be done.
Then the guards slammed the door and barred it. 5. Amory had heard the sounds of fighting in the corridor outside and pressed her ear to the boards of the locked door to confirm her suspicions. It had to be Stein or Felice. Could one of them have been driven insane by the shock of the translation? Or was there a good reason for the violent outburst? She tore open her backpack and rummaged in the small holder unit for the small plastic envelope holding the cord saw. Dragging one of the benches over to the window, she tucked her skirts into her rope belt and jumped up. Cut halfway through the upper bars of the brass grill on the inside. Cut all of the way through the bottom bars. Then lever the whole thing outward with the top of another bench after I smash it apart. I could unbraid the rug and make a rope out of the wool. But wait, the Decamol bridge sections would work. 2 for a ladder, and the 3rd to cross over the area with those damn bear dogs.
Oh, sister, what are you doing?
She whirled around,
hampered by both index fingers being engaged in the rings of the cord saw. Tully and a burly guardian stood at the open door. The little interviewer's tunic was covered with dark stains.
"Please come down, sister. What a dreadfully reckless thing to think of. And all so unnecessary, believe me. You are in no danger."
Amory locked eyes with him, then stepped down, resigned. The big guardian held out his hand for the saw, and she gave it to him without a word. He tucked it into one of the pockets of her pack and said,
"I'll carry this for you, sister."
Tully said,
"We are having to expedite our usual interview program because of a most regrettable accident, so if you will accompany Shubash and me..."
"I heard sounds of fighting," she said. "Who was hurt? Was it Felice?"
She strode to the open door and looked out into the corridor.
"Merciful God!"
Guardians had removed the dead and injured, and cleanup crews were sluicing the walls and floor with big buckets of water, but traces of mayhem were still sickeningly apparent.
"What have you done?" Amory cried.
"The blood is that of our own people."
Tully was somber.
"It was shed by your companion, Stein. He, by the way, is unhurt, except for bruises. But five of our men are dead, and seven others seriously injured."
"Oh, Lord, how did it happen?"
"I'm sorry to say that Stein went berserk. It must have been a delayed reaction to the temporal translation. Passage through the time portal sometimes triggers deeply buried psychic explosives. We try to protect both the travelers and ourselves by confining new arrivals to these reception rooms for a while during the recovery period, which is why your door was locked."
"I'm sorry about your people," she told him
with sincere regret.
"Steiny is strange, but a dear man when you get to know him. What will happen to him now?"
Tully fingered his gray collar.
"We who guard the gateway have our duty, and at times it is a heavy one. Your friend has received treatment that should preclude another attack. He won't be punished any more than the sick man is punished for his illness. Now, sister, we must hurry you along to the next phase of our interview. The Lady Ipon requires your assistance."
They passed through the dreadful hallway and down the stairs to a small office on the other side of the Barbican. Felice Landry was waiting alone, seated in an ordinary cushioned chair beside a table that held a metal sculpture all studded with jewels. The two men conducted Amory inside and withdrew, closing the door.
"Felice, Stein has... I know,"
the athlete interrupted in a whisper. She put one gloved finger to her lips, then sat silent, holding her emerald-plumed leather helmet demurely in her lap. With her hair standing out from her head and her enormous brown eyes wide, she looked like a pretty child waiting to be forced on stage for some sinister theatrical performance. The door opened, and Ipon glided in. Amory stared at the immensely tall figure in astonishment.
"Another sentient race?" the nun blurted out. "Here?"
Ipon inclined her majestic head.
"I will explain it to you shortly, sister. Everything will be clarified in good time. For now, I require your assistance in gaining the confidence of your young companion for a simple test of mental abilities."
She picked up a silver coronet from the table and approached Felice with it.
"No, no, I told you, I won't let you,"
the girl shrieked.
"And if you try to force me, I won't register. I know all about these rotten mind tricks."
Ipon appealed to Amory. "Her fears are irrational. All of the newly arrived timefarers consent to the test for latent metabilities. If we discover that you possess them, we have the technology to bring them up to operancy so that you and all of the community may enjoy their benefits."
"You want to probe me?"
Felice spat out.
Certainly not. The test is a simple calibration.
Amari suggested. Perhaps if you tested me first, I'm quite sure that my own NP latencies are minimal, but it would probably reassure Felice if she could see just what happens in the test.
An excellent idea, Ippone said, smiling. Amari took Felice's hand and raised her from the chair. She could feel the trembling fingers even through the leather glove, but the emotion hidden in those unfathomable eyes was something much different from fear. The nun spoke soothingly. Stand there, Felice. You can watch while I go through this, and then if the idea still distresses you, I'm sure this lady will respect your personal convictions. She turned to Ippone. Won't you?
I assure you I mean no harm, the Tanu woman replied. And as Felice has said, the test will not give proper results unless the subject cooperates. Please be seated, sister.
Amari unfastened the pin that held her black veil, then slipped off the soft white wimple that had covered her hair. Ippone set the silver coronet on the nun's brown curls. First, we will test the far-sensing function. If you would, sister, without speaking, attempt to tell me greetings.
Amari squeezed her eyes shut. One point of the coronet acquired a faint violet spark.
-7, very weak. Now for the coercive faculty. Sister, exert all of your willpower upon me. Force me to close my eyes.
Amari glowered in concentration. Another point of the coronet drew a somewhat more intense bluish spark.
-3. Stronger, but still far below the potentially useful range. Now let us test psychokinesis. Try very hard, sister. Levitate yourself in your chair, just 1 centimeter above the floor.
The resultant rosy gold spark was hardly visible, and the chair stayed firmly on the flagstones.
Ah, a pity. -8. Relax now, sister. In testing the creative function, we will ask you to spin an illusion for us. Close your eyes and visualize a common object. Perhaps your shoe, suspended in mid-air before you. Will this object to appear before us? Try hard.
A greenish spark, like a miniature star, and was it really there? The faintest phantasm of a hiking boot.
Do you see, Felice? The Tanu exclaimed. +3.5.
Amari's eyes popped open and the illusion vanished.
Do you mean I actually did it?
The coronet artificially enhances your natural creativity, converting it from latent to operant. Unfortunately, your psychic potential in the faculty is so low as to be virtually useless, even with maximum gain.
It figures, said the nun. Bene creator spiritus. Don't call me, I'll call you.
There is one more test for the MP function that is to us most important of all. Ippone manipulated the crystalline device, which had begun to flicker. When the glow in the jewels had steadied, she said,
Look into my eyes, sister. Look beneath them, into my mind if you are able to. Can you perceive what is hidden there? Can you analyze it? Collate its scattered bits back to coherency. Heal its wounds and scars and voids of pain. Try.
Try?
Oh, poor one. You want to let me, don't you? But strong. Too strong. Looking out at me, beating on transparent walls so strong, and now darkening, darkening, black.
A red spark had flared for a brief moment, a microscopic nova. It dimmed to near invisibility. Ippone sighed.
-7 ultimate redact. I would have given much, but enough.
She removed the coronet and turned to Felice with a kindly expression.
Will you permit me to test you now, child? Felice whispered.
I can't. Please don't make me do it.
We can wait until later, Infania, Ippon said. Very likely you are a normal human woman, as your friend is. But even for you without metafaculties, we can offer a world of happiness and fulfillment. All women enjoy a privileged position in the many-colored land, because so few pass through the time portal. You will be cherished. Amory paused in the act of restoring her headdress and said,
You should know, from a study of our customs, that some of our priests are consecrated virgins. I'm one. And Felice is not heterosexually oriented.
Ippon said, That's a pity. But given time, you will adjust to the new status and be happy.
Felice stepped forward and spoke very quietly. Do you mean to tell us that women are sexually subservient to men here in exile?
Ippon's lips curved upward. What is subservience? And what is fulfillment? It is feminine nature to be the vessel yearning to be filled, to be the nurturer and sustainer, to spend the self in giving care to the beloved other. When that destiny is denied, there can only be a void, weeping and rage, as I and so many other women of my race know only too well. We of the Tano came here long ago, from a galaxy at the farthest limits of Earth's visibility. Exiles driven forth because we refuse to modify our lifestyle according to principles abhorrent to us. In many ways, this planet has been an ideal refuge, but its atmosphere fails to screen out certain particles that are detrimental to our reproductive capacity. Tano women produce healthy children rarely, and with great difficulty. Nevertheless, we are vowed to racial survival. We prayed through the hopeless centuries, and at length, Mother Tana answered us.
A dawning realization came to Amory. Felice showed no emotion. The nun said, All of the human women, going through the time gate, have been sterilized.
By reversible salpingotomy, said the serene exotic. Amory sprang to her feet.
Even if you undo it, the genetics...
are compatible. Our ship, who brought us here, blessed be its memory, chose this galaxy and this world for the perfect compatibility of the germplasm. It was expected that eons would have to ensue before we achieved full reproductive potential, even using the native life form you call ramipithecine as a nurturer of the zygote. But we live so very long, and we have such power. So we endured until the miracle occurred and the time portal opened and began sending you to us. Sister, you and Felice are young and healthy. You will cooperate, as others of your sex have done, because the rewards are great and the punishments insupportable.
Fuck you, said the nun.
Ippon walked to the door. The interview is at an end. You will both prepare for the caravan journey to Fenaya. It is a beautiful city on the Proto-Rhine near the site of your future Freiburg. Humans of goodwill live happily there, served by our good little Ramas so that they are relieved of all drudgery. You will learn contentment. Believe me. She went out and softly closed the door. Amory turned to Felice.
The bastards! The rotten bastards! Don't worry, Amory, said the athlete. She didn't test me, that's the important thing. I kept smearing pathetic whinings over my thoughts all of the time that she was near me. So if she could read me at all, she probably believes I'm nothing but a poor little leather gal.
What are you going to do, try to escape?
Felice's dark eyes glowed, and she laughed out loud.
More? I'm gonna take him. The whole goddamn lot.
6.
There were benches under the trees at the walled compound, but Claude Majeski chose to sit on the pavement in the shade of the animal pen partition where he could watch the living fossil beasts and brood. He turned the carved zacopane box over and over in his big hands. "A fine end to your frivolity, old man. Sold down the river in your 133rd year. And all because of a crazy whimsical gesture. Oh, you Polacks always were romantic fools." "Is that why you loved me, black girl?" The really humiliating aspect was that it had taken Claude so long to figure the thing out. Didn't he welcome the first friendly contact, the attractive sitting room with the food, and the John, all nicely calculated to soothe the frightened old poop after the stress of translation? Wasn't Tully genial and harmless, drawing him out and flattering him and dishing the cod swallop about the great life of peace and happiness they would all enjoy in exile? All right, Tully had overdone it just a little. And the first sight of Epone had all but stupefied him. The unexpected presence of an exotic on Pliocene Earth, numbing his natural prudence while she measured him, found him wanting, and dismissed him. Even when the armed guards led him politely across the courtyard, he had been docile as a lamb, until the last minute, when they took away his pack, opened the gate, and pushed him into the people pen.
"Easy does it, traveler," one guard had said. "You'll get your pack back later if you behave yourself. Make trouble, and we have the means to subdue you. Try to escape, and you join the bear dogs for dinner."
Claude had stood there with his mouth open, until a sane-looking fellow prisoner in alpine climbing kit came over and led him into the shade. After an hour or so, Claude's pack was returned by a guard. Any equipment that might have aided in escape had been removed. He was told that the Vitrador woodworking tools would be returned to him when he was safe in Fenaya. After the first shock had passed off, Claude explored the people pen. It was actually a large and well-shaded yard with ornamental walls of pierced stonework, more than 3 meters high, patrolled by guards. An indoor extension led to a fairly comfortable dormitory and a washroom. The compound held 8 women and 33 men. Claude recognized most of them from having watched their early morning march through the Auberge Gardens to the Guderian cottage. They represented approximately 1 week's bag of timefarers, with the missing ones presumed to have been sorted out by Epone's test and shunted to some alternate destiny. Claude soon discovered that the only one of his comrades from Group Green in the pen was Richard. He lay in an ominous sleep on one of the dormitory bunks. He would not awaken when the old man shook him by the shoulder.
"We've a few others like him," said the alpine climber.
His face was long, weathered, and finely wrinkled with the indeterminate middle-aged look of decaying rejuvenation. He had humorous gray eyes and ash-colored hair beneath his Tyrolean hat.
"Some people just seem to drop out of it, poor devils. Still, they're better off than the Lizzie who hanged himself day before yesterday. You lot today are the last of the week's consignment. Tonight we'll move out. Just be glad you haven't had to stick it out here for 6 days like some of us."
"Did any try to escape?" Claude asked.
"A few before I came. A Cossack named Preshepa from my group, 3 Polynesians yesterday. The bear dogs even ate their feathered cloaks. Pity. Do you like recorder music? I feel like a bit of Purcell. Name's Basil Winborn, by the way."
He sat down on a vacant bunk, took out a wooden flute, and began to play a plaintive melody. The old man recalled that Brian had often whistled snatches of it. Claude listened for a few minutes, then wandered back outside. Other time travelers were reacting to their imprisonment according to their individual psychology. An aging artist bent over a sketch pad. Side by side under a tree sat a young couple dressed as Yankee pioneers.
caressing one another in oblivious passion. 5 gypsy men argued conspiratorially and practiced close combat lunges with invisible knives. A perspiring middle-aged male in a rabbit-trimmed toga and kid-skin domino kept demanding that the guards give him back his discipline. 2 Japanese ronin, some swords but otherwise attired in handsome 14th-century armor, were playing goben with a decimal board. A lovely woman veiled in rainbow chiffon resolved her tensions in dance. The guards outside had to keep discouraging her from climbing up the walls and leaping into space like a billowy butterfly, crying, "Paris, adieu!" In a shady spot sat an australoid black man in a crisp white shirt, riding breeches, and elastic-sided boots. The 4 tiny speakers of his music library were arranged about him, endlessly alternating Der Erpenig with an antique cut of Will Bradley's Celery Stalks at Midnight. A fellow dressed in jester's motley juggled 3 silver balls with persistent lack of skill before an audience of an elderly woman and her Shih Tzu puppy, which never tired of chasing the balls. Perhaps the most pathetic of the prisoners was a tall, robust man with a ginger beard and hollow eyes, beautifully accoutred in imitation chainmail, and a medieval knight's silken surtout emblazoned with a golden lion. He strode about the compound in a frenzy of agitation, peering through the holes in the wall and crying,
"Ostlin! Ostlin! Where are you now that I need you? Save us from La Belle Dame sans merci!"
Claude decided that he was up a very shitty creek indeed. For some perverse reason, he felt almost pleased with himself. He picked up a fallen leafy twig and poked it through one of the ornamental apertures into the adjacent animal corral. "Here, boy! Here, boy!" One of the creatures on the other side of the wall pricked its tufted horse-like ears and ambled over for a taste. Claude watched it in delight as it first nipped off the leaves with tiny cropping teeth, then champed the woody parts with its strong molars. When the tidbit was swallowed, the animal gave him a look that plainly reproached his lack of generosity, so he got it more leaves. It was a calicothere, a member of one of the most peculiar and fascinating families of Cenozoic mammals. Its body was massive and deep-chested, nearly 3 meters long, and with a horse-like neck and head that testified to its peristodactyl affinities. Its front legs were somewhat longer than the hind ones, and at least twice as stout as those of a draft horse. Instead of terminating in hoofs, the feet bore 3 toes, ending in huge, semi-retractile claws. The inner ones on the front feet were nearly the size of a human hand, with the others only half as large. The calicothere's body was clothed in a short, hairy coat of bluish-gray, dotted with white spots about the withers, flanks, and hindquarters. Its tail was rudimentary, but the creature did boast a fine mane of long black hair, a black streak down the spine, and flashy black featherings at the fetlocks. The intelligent eyes were set a bit farther forward on the skull than those of a horse, and were fringed with heavy black lashes that the beast batted fetchingly. It wore a leather bridle and was thoroughly domesticated. The corral held at least 60 of the animals, most of them dapple gray, with occasional white or sorrel individuals. The Pliocene sun ascended over the barbican and finally shone directly into the courtyard, driving all but the most hardy prisoners into the relative coolness of the stone dormitory. A surprisingly decent noon meal of bay-leaf-seasoned stew, fruit, and wine punch was served. Claude again tried vainly to awaken Richard, and finally stowed the pirate's food under his bunk. After lunch, most of the prisoners retired for a siesta, but Claude went back outside to pace his digestion into submission and speculate on his fate. About 2 hours later, stable hands dressed in gray began toting in large baskets of gnarled tubers and fat roots resembling mangelwurzels. They dumped these into troughs for the animals. While the calicothers were feeding, the men mucked out the pen with big twig brooms and wooden shovels, dumped the manure into wheeled carts, and trundled it off toward the corridor leading to the castle's postern gate.
Two of the hands stayed behind with a portable pump apparatus, which they immersed in the central fountain. While one man pumped a stirrup, the other unreeled a stiff canvas hose with which he washed the floor of the corral, the excess water draining off into gutters. When the pavement was clean, he turned the spray onto the feeding animals. They uttered whickers and squeals of delight. The old paleontologist nodded with satisfaction. Water lovers, root eaters. So calicotheres were denizens of the damp semi-tropical forest, or muddy river bottomlands, and they did use their claws to dig for roots. A minor mystery of paleobiology was solved. For him, at least. But were the prisoners actually going to have to ride such archaic steeds? The beasts wouldn't be as fast as horses, but they looked as though they had a lot of endurance. And their gait, Claude winced. If one of those creatures cantered with him aboard, his old knees and hip joints were going to shatter like antique Christmas tree ornaments. A sound in the shadowed cloister caught his attention. Soldiers were leading two new prisoners to the back door of the compound, which opened into the dormitory. Claude saw a waving green plume and a glimpse of black and white. Felice and Amarie. He hurried inside and was standing there as the two women were led into the prison. One guard put down their packs, which he had carried, and said in a friendly fashion,
"Won't be long to wait now. Better get something to eat from the leftovers on the table over there."
The knight errant came running over to them with a tragic expression.
"Is Aslan on his way? Have you seen him, good sister? Perhaps this warrior maid is of his entourage. Aslan must come or we are doomed."
"Oh, piss off," muttered Felice. Claude took the knight by the mailed elbow and led him to a bunk near the other door. "Stay here and watch for Aslan." The man nodded solemnly and sat down. Somewhere in the dimness, another prisoner was weeping. The alpinist was playing Greensleeves on his recorder. When Claude returned to his friends, he found Felice rooting in her pack and cursing.
"All missing. The arbalist, my skinning knives, the ropes. Just about every damn thing I might have used to get us out of here."
"You might as well forget it," Claude told her. "If you resort to violence, they'll collar you. That fellow playing the flute told me about a prisoner who went bonkers and attacked a mess attendant. Soldiers clubbed him down and put one of those gray metal neck rings on him. When he stopped screaming and recovered his senses, he was as mild as milk. Couldn't get the collar off, either." Felice swore more eloquently.
"Are they planning to collar us all, then?"
Claude glanced around, but nobody was paying the slightest attention to them. "Evidently not. As nearly as I can judge, the gray collars are a crude type of psychoregulator, probably linked to the golden ones worn by the Lady Ipone and other exotics. Not all of the castle personnel wear collars. Soldiers and guardians do, and straw bosses like the worthy Tully. But the stable hands don't have collars, and neither do the mess attendants."
"Not in sensitive enough positions?" suggested the nun.
"Or maybe the hardware is in short supply," Claude said. Felice frowned.
"That could be. It would need a sophisticated technology to manufacture things like that. And so far, this outfit looks damn Mickey Mouse. Did you see how that mind collaborator kept fritzing out? And no running water in these reception rooms."
"They didn't bother to take any of my pharmaceuticals," said Amarie. "The collars must protect the guards from any drugging we might be tempted to try. Handy gadgets. No slave overseer should be without some."
"They may not need to collar people to keep them down," Claude said, grim.
He gestured at the dormitory's listless inmates.
"Just look at this crew. A few lively ones tried to escape and they were fed to the bear dogs. I think that most folks falling into a nightmare like this are so traumatized that they just float for a while and hope things won't get worse. The guards are cheerful and spin yarns about the good life waiting for us. The food's not bad. Wouldn't you just take it easy and see what develops instead of fighting it?"
"No," said Felice.
Amarie added, "The women's expectations aren't quite so rosy, Claude. She told him tersely of their interview with Ipon and of the origins and reproductive predicament of the exotic race. So, while you may be able to live peacefully, building log cabins, Claude, Felice and I are going to be turned into broodmares.
Damn them, whispered the old man. Damn them.
He stared at his big hands, still strong, but blotched with liver spots and corded with blue veins.
I wouldn't be worth a fart in a teacup in any real dust-up. What we really need is Stein.
They took him, Amarie said, and explained how Tully told her that the Viking had been treated to prevent further trouble. They all knew what that had to mean.
Are any of the others here? Felice asked.
Just Richard, said the old man. But he's been asleep ever since I was put in here this morning. I couldn't wake him either. Maybe you ought to take a look at him, Amarie.
The nun took her pack and followed Claude to Richard's bunk. It was surrounded by empty beds for a reason that was easily apparent. The sleeping man had soiled himself. His arms were folded tightly over his breast, and his knees were drawn up nearly to his chin. Amarie lifted one eyelid, then took his pulse.
Jesus, he's close to catatonic. What could they have done to him?
She searched in her pack and came up with a mini-doser, which she pressed to Richard's temple. As the bulblet collapsed and the powerful drug entered the unconscious man's bloodstream, he gave a faint moan.
There's a chance this might bring him around if he's not too far gone, the nun said. Meanwhile, will you guys help me clean him up?
Right, said Felice, starting to shuck her armor.
His pack's here. He ought to have other clothes.
I'll get water, Claude said.
He headed for the washroom, where there was a stone tank supplied by a conduit from the fountain. He filled a wooden bucket and brought soap and quantities of rough towels. As he sloshed back between the bunks, one of the gypsies eyed him.
You help your friend, old man. But maybe he's better off the way he is. Useless to them.
A woman with a hairless head clutched at him. She wore wrinkled yellow robes, and her oriental face was ravaged by scars. An unusual sight. Perhaps they were part of her religious devotion.
We wanted to be free, she croaked. But these monsters from another galaxy will enslave us. And the worst of it is, they look human.
Claude pulled away from her. Trying to ignore other cries and whispers, he made his way to Richard's bed.
I gave him another shot, Amarie said grimly. It'll bring him around, or kill him. Damn, if only we could give him a sugar drip.
The knight gave a shout.
They're starting to saddle the fairy steeds. We'll soon be on our way to Narnia.
See what's going on, Claude, Felice ordered. He pushed through the others who were hurrying outside and managed to get close to the perforated wall nearest the central court. Stable hands were leading pairs of calicothers from the corral to ranks of hitching rails across the yard. More servitors brought out piles of tack and started placing pads on the animals' backs. To one side, eight of the beasts were segregated for special treatment, their bronze-studded harness and other equipment marking them as soldiers' mounts. An amused voice at Claude's shoulder said,
"Don't seem to think we'll need much guarding on the trip, do they?"
It was Basil, the alpine hiker, watching the proceedings with interest.
"Ah, there's the explanation. Catch the clever modification of the stirrups?"
Bronze chains dangled from them. They were padded with narrow leather sleeves and would probably hang loosely enough about the ankle to be only minimally uncomfortable when fastened. The saddling took some time, and the sun westered behind the castle. It was obvious that they were scheduled for a night march in order to avoid the daytime heat of the savannah. A squad of four troopers led by an officer wearing a short blue cloak came marching to the compound gate and unbarred it. The soldiers were attired in light bronze kettle helmets and peace armor worn over tan shirts and shorts. They were armed with intricately pulleyed compound bows, bronze short swords, and Vitradoy lances. As the soldiers entered the pen, the prisoners fell back. The officer addressed the crowd in a matter-of-fact voice.
All you travelers, it is nearly time to move out of here. I am your caravan leader, Captain Valdemar. We're going to get to know each other pretty good in the next week or so. I know you've had a hard time, some of you,
staying in this hot compound while you waited for the contingent to be complete. But things will be better soon. We're on our way north to the city of Fenaya, where you'll be making your home. It's a good place, a lot cooler than here. The journey is about 400 kilometers, and it will take us about 6 days. We'll go by night for 2 days here in the hot country, then switch to day travel when we hit the Harsinian forest. Now you travelers listen. Don't give me any trouble, and you'll get good food at stations along the way. Fuck up and you'll be short-rationed. Make me really unhappy, and you won't eat at all. Any of you travelers who think you'd like to escape, just think about the fossil zoo waiting bright-eyed and bushy-tailed for stragglers on foot. We got saber-toothed cats like super lions and hyenas the size of grizzly bears. We got wild boars bigger than oxen that take a human leg off with one bite. We got rhinos and mastodons that'll stomp you to death if they even catch sight of you. And the dinosauriums, the Ho-Tusker elephants, they like to use people for cute tug-of-war games and then dance on the pieces. They only stand 4 or 5 meters at the shoulder, by the way. You escape the big buggers and you can get nailed by the small fry. The creeks are full of pythons and crocs. The woods have poisonous spiders with bodies like peaches and fangs like gaboon vipers. You get away from the animals, and the Fearvalog will track you down and play devil tunes on your mind until you go mad or die from the horrors. It's bad out there, travelers. It's not the pretty Eden world they told you about in A.D. 2110. But nobody has to worry if they stick with the caravan. You're going to ride those critters that you've been looking at in the pen next door. They're calicothers, kind of a distant relative of the horse, and we call them chalicos. They're smart, and they like people, and with those claws they have, nothing messes with them much. Be nice to your chalico. He's transportation and a bodyguard in one package. Now, in case any of you travelers feel like riding off into the tall timber, forget it. These torques, these necklets that us soldiers wear, let us keep complete control of the chalicos. You leave the driving to us, and we'll also have trained amphicians ranging along the flanks of the caravan. Those bear dogs know that any rider who tries to light out is fair meat. So live cool, and we'll all have a good ride. Right. Now I want you to get your stuff together. You can either transfer your things from packs into saddlebags, or just lash your rig behind the cantle of the saddle. I understand two of you have pet animals with you. We'll have pannier baskets that they can ride in. The guy that brought the pregnant goat, your animal will have to stay here until the weekly trade and supply caravan brings it on. Most of your proscribed tools and weapons and the bulky stuff taken from you when you first arrived will be carried on our pack animals. You may get most of the things back eventually if you behave. Everything clear? Right. I want all of you lined up here 2 by 2 and ready to ride in half an hour. When you hear a big bell ring, you know you got just 5 minutes to line up or it's your ass. That's all. He turned on his heel and marched out with his detail following. They didn't even bother to bar the gate. Murmuring, the prisoners began shuffling back inside to gather their belongings. Claude reflected that night travel was another demoralizing factor calculated to stifle notions of escape, as were the inflated descriptions of Pliocene fauna. Spiders as big as peaches, forsooth? Next it would be the giant rat of Sumatra. On the other hand, the amphicians were a real enough menace. He wondered how fast they could run on those primitive digitigrade feet, and what in the world were the horrendous Fearvalog? Across the yard, another party under guard was emerging from the gatehouse. Hostlers cut out 6 animals from the main remuda and led them to a mounting platform. Claude saw one slim figure in gold lamé being helped aboard a saddled chalico, and there was another standing by in a scarlet jumpsuit, and a third.
"Aiken!" the old man shouted.
"Elizabeth, it's me, Claude!" The figure in red began to remonstrate with another blue-caped captain of the guard. The arguing got louder and louder, and finally Elizabeth stamped her foot and the man shrugged. She broke from the group and ran across the courtyard,
the officer following at leisure. She pulled open the people pen gate and threw herself into the white-haired paleontologist's arms.
"Kiss me," she whispered breathlessly. "You're supposed to be my lover."
He folded her to his breast while the soldier eyed him with interested speculation. Elizabeth said,
"They're sending us to the capital, Moriah. My metafunctions are returning, Claude. I'm going to do my best to get away. If I do, I'll try to help you all somehow."
"That's enough now, lady," said the soldier. "I don't care what Lord Crayon told you, you've got to get ready to ride."
"Goodbye, Claude."
She gave him a real kiss, full on the lips, before she was hurried back across the courtyard and helped onto her mount. One of the soldiers fastened the slender chains about her ankles. Claude raised one hand.
"Goodbye, Elizabeth."
From a covered area behind the main animal pen came a majestic figure, riding a snow-white chalico with scarlet and silver trappings. The captal saluted, then he and two soldiers swung into their saddles. A command rang out.
"All ready! Portcullis up!"
The file of 10 riders went slowly into the arched passage of the Barbican. There was a distant, excited howling from the bear dogs. The last prisoner in line turned to wave at Claude before he disappeared into the shadowed opening.
"And goodbye to you, Brian," thought the old man. "I hope you find your mercy, one way or another."
He went back into the dormitory to help with Richard, feeling old and weary, and not at all pleased with himself anymore. 7. The party of 10 formed up to ride 2 by 2 as soon as they had quit Castle Gateway. Crayon and his captor led, and the two soldiers followed behind the small group of prisoners. The sun was just down, and they traveled eastward into the dusk, down the gradual slope of the plateau, toward the twilit Rhone-Saone Valley. Elizabeth sat easily in her saddle, eyes closed and hands clasped on the pommel, while the reins lay free. It was fortunate that the chalico did not require guidance from its rider, because Elizabeth was fully occupied in listening. "Listen, but be unaware of the sounds made by the mounts plodding over soft earth. Do not hear the crickets, the frogs tuning up in the misty swales, scattered in the hollows of the tableland. Be deaf to the birds' evensong, the distant yelping of hyenids emerging for the night's hunt, the murmuring voices of companion riders. Listen not with the ears, but with the newly recovered metapsychic, far-sensing faculty. Reach out afar, afar. Search for other minds like your own, other speakers. Other, please God, true people. Shame on you for that, arrogant Sicky, but be forgiven just this once. Listen, listen. The reborn ultra-sense is not yet fully operant, and yet there are things to be heard. Here in the party, the guarded exotic consciousness of Crayon in converse with his captal, dark-minded Zdenko. The two concealed behind a torque-generated screen easily breached. But forbear, since they would be aware of the penetration. Pass over Aiken and the other Silver Torque prisoners, the man Raimo and the woman Suki, their infantile mental babblings as grating as the efforts of fledgling violinists, importuning the ears of a cranky virtuoso. Ignore the gray-torqued guards and poor unconscious Stein, and Brian, with his brain still unfettered except by chains of his own forging. Leave them all, and journey afar. Listen back at the castle, where another exotic voice is, yes, singing. Lesser notes of silver and gray respond in dim echoing of the golden tone. Listen ahead, closer to the great river, to a complex alien mutter. Exaltation, impatience, anticipated dark joy, cruelty. Drop that horrid thing until later. Listen farther east, north, northwest, and south.
perceive other concentrations, golden amorphous clots, betokening the presence of still more of the artificially enhanced exotic minds, their thoughts too numerous and unfocused for your convalescent mind to sort, their harmonies and occasional peaks of power so strange, yet so achingly familiar in their resemblance to the metapsychic networks of the dear lost milieu. Listen to the anomalies, soft gibberings and puerile thrusts. Other unhuman minds, unaugmented by torques, perhaps genuinely operant? What? Who? Where? Data inconclusive, but there are many. Listen to faint traceries of dread patterns and pain patterns and resignation loss patterns coming from God knew where or what. Shrink back. Press past them and beyond. Listening. Listening. That! A fleeting contact from the north that winks out in a spasm of apprehension as soon as you touch it. Tano? Enhanced human far speaker. Call out, but receive no response. Project friendship and need, but hear no answer. Perhaps you imagined it after all. Listen afar, afar. Sound the entire exile world. Are any of you here, sisters and brothers of the mind? Do any far sense in the uniquely human mode that the exotics cannot know? Answer, Elizabeth Orme, far speaker, redactor, searcher, hoper, prayer. Answer. Planet Oriol. Emanations of lower life forms, mental whispers from normal humanity, the jabber of the Tanu and their torqued minions, an ambiguous murmur from the other side of the world, evanescent as a remembered dream. Is it real or revertebrate? Imagination or reality? Track it, lose it, hover despairingly, and know that it never was.